In this passage, in this text that was elaborated by Pettinato, then translated by Heidel, Botero, Kramer, etc. Therefore, we are in the field of academic translations. It speaks of when the Anunna or Anunnaki worked the earth and says, after the gods had established the rules of heaven and earth, after they had laid the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates to dams and canals, then Enlil, one of the two sons of the ruler of the empire, spoke to them. What do you want to do now? What do you want to create now? O Anunna, great gods, what do you want to do now? The great gods who were seated and the Anunna who decide the fates all together answered Enlil, in Uzumua of Duranki we will kill the Allah gods so that their blood may sprout mankind. The corvée of the gods is their task. That is, the blood of the Allah is taken, the blood is pulled out, which then in the story of the formation of the Adamu is purified, and purified obviously to obtain this. That is to obtain the Tizilem, that something cut off, that material, something that contains the image that is transferred, and we know that this material, something that is cut out and contains the image, is the DNA. And then he says that, men forever tend the border ditches. Let them take up the hoe and the working basket for the temple of the great gods, which is suitable for the lofty throne. Let them add field to field. Forever the ditches of cured border. That is, basically, you have a whole list of jobs, and they say, let's do these here and transfer all these hard jobs to them. We sit quietly in our palaces to govern, which is exactly what the Elohim do. They make someone work their Gan Eden.
Mauro Biglino is an internationally best-selling Italian author, researcher, and highly regarded scholar of ancient Hebrew. For many years, he worked for Rome's St. Paul Press as a Bible translator, providing with great precision the literal meaning of Hebrew words for Vatican-approved interlinear Bibles. It is an exacting discipline. The scholar must be rigorous in avoiding any kind of interpretation of the word and give only the literal etymological meaning of each word part. Mauro's findings set him at odds with the conventional expectations of the Catholic world and propelled him onto the international stage where his work has opened up a world of cultural memory recorded in the Bible. Yet hidden from the public for centuries by mistaken translation and the dogmas of the Church.
Good morning. Today we resume with the second video on the relationship between the Bible and Greek texts, Homer in particular. Because in reality, they are books that tell us the same stories, only that one is traditionally granted a certain authority, and the other, the others, the Iliad and the Odyssey, are instead interpreted as fables, myths. But we know that if we always approach them as if they were real accounts, always believing that if we give credit to what is written both in the Bible and in the Homeric poems, particularly in this case, perhaps we can understand much more. The other time, for example, I read what a French Hellenist, Paul Louis Courier, wrote, that Homer is absolutely historical. This is precisely an affirmation to which Schliemann obviously gave credit, which we must never forget, because it is an example, truly a paradigm of the relationship between the possibility of having true knowledge and those who unfortunately at times are holding the power on knowledge. They do not want things to change, and therefore when they have established that certain texts, certain volumes are fables, they must remain so while others are taken for historians. We know that this definition of myths, legends, fairy tales is unfortunately also attributed to the Bible. But this set of attitudes, I always repeat because it is fundamental, prevents us from understanding a lot of things. And therefore we, as usual, pretend that the Bible and Homeric texts tell us similar stories. Today in particular, we will deal with a very interesting concept, enkitheoi, connected to a Hebrew term, tzelem. Enkitheoi tzelem. Then I'll leave the space here because I have to write more, then we'll get there. But what is interesting is precisely the fundamental concept that must underlie the analyses we do. It is the basis of our freedom of approach to these texts. A text by Professor Satlow, who teaches religious studies and Judaism at Brown University in Rhode Island, here tells us about the birth, the reasons for the birth of the Bible, the use of the Bible in Jerusalem, the use of the Greek Bible in Alexandria and Egypt. But the important concept is this, because it is the basis of a whole series of situations that we live in. In any case, this is why I always say that knowing the past and pretending it's true, trying to understand it, is very useful for us. He says, the oracular dimension of biblical authority continues to exert a powerful fascination on the communities, albeit in different forms from the ancient ones. The oracular authority venerates a text, but uses the text it venerates in order to attribute power, prestige, and once again, authority to its interpreters. This is the kind of dynamic that has led to the formation of most of the world's major religions. The texts that these institutions and organizations place on their altars and offer to the narrative of the faithful are in a sense subjected to the discretion of the community of their interpreters. What is important to understand is that whoever controls the past, who controls knowledge, whoever manages the past actually controls the present and plans for the future. And that is why it is interesting instead to know the past. Try to know it and get out of the patterns that are proposed to us because, for example, among the schemes that are proposed to us, one is that the Greeks lived on myths. They invented a lot of myths to explain things, to explain them to the people, etc. But in reality, they didn't believe in them. No, let's be careful. Paul Vane, archaeologist, professor at the Collège de France, among many others, also wrote this text. The Greeks believed in their myths. A text which contains very important concepts because they help us understand all this speech we are doing. Apparently, it only helps us understand the relationship with the Greeks, but in reality, it helps us understand much more. And for those who are interested, it is very important. For the Greeks, criticizing myths did not consist in demonstrating their falsehood, but rather in rediscovering the basis of truth. This is what we are trying to do humbly, quietly, but with a little determination, because this truth has been covered with lies. We have already said it other times when speaking of Sanchuniathon, who uncovered how many lies had been used to obscure the concrete truth of ancient Egyptian history by the priestly caste. Well, Pausanias quotes the French author. He says, by always erecting an edifice of imagination on a foundation of truth, most people have been led not to believe in events that have happened other times and are still happening. Attention. Those who like to hear the tale of myths are also led to add their futilities to these. That is, everyone then, since they are myths, everyone is free to elaborate. No. Those who add futility achieve nothing else in this way than to deny that truth which they contaminate with lies. For the Greeks, the genesis of myths did not create difficulties. In their depths, myths are authentic historical traditions. How could one indeed speak of what doesn't exist? You can alter the truth, but you couldn't talk about nothing. These are very important concepts that must underlie our approach to ancient texts. Strabo believes that every myth has an educational purpose, and that the poet, that is Homer, did not write the Odyssey to amuse, but to teach geography, and therefore it is impossible for a myth to be entirely mythical. Ulysses' travels are a course in geography where everything is true. And so on. I'll just read you one more passage because it's important, but above all, with the final closing, which is absolutely amazing. Here he speaks of Palifato, then another of the scholars. He does not doubt even for a moment the historicity of Daedalus, Pelops, and Iolaus, which he demonstrates as Polybius will do. He also admits that in those distant times, the gods united with men. How many times have we said this? Perhaps someone will remember when I spoke of, when we lived with the Elohim. Here was a drawing, a graph showing the centuries in which the Elohim and the Adamites lived together, even united sexually. Athena and Apollo participated in the torture of Marzia, and Apollo really loved Hyacinthus, even if, he says, it would be childish to believe that this god wrote the name of his lover on the petals of a flower. Obviously, the truth is that Apollo limited himself to give this flower the name of the beautiful teenager. That is, we are in the context of very concrete and therefore credible stories. But let's get to the curious aspect in particular, because here we also extend to the religiosity of the Romans. He says, "Now, if our intention is not to construct dogmas on the existence of God or gods, we will have to limit ourselves to stating that the Greeks believed in their gods." And speaking of the cult that was reserved for emperors, you know that they were deified, for which we are led by our tradition, by our education to say. Fortunately, on the one hand, there was the Bible, which with the Jews achieved the very high religious peak of monotheism. Because on the other side, there were the pagans who, poor things, they were so stupid that they even deified their emperors. Listen to what he says. One fact shows how far our duplicity with ourselves goes. Even if the emperors were considered gods, and your archaeologists have found tens of thousands of ex-votos dedicated to different gods for healing, for the happy return, exactly like ours, that is, every people, every culture, every time has its gods who heal, its gods who work miracles. Therefore, we Christians, we educated in Christianity, we must not delude ourselves that we are the only ones. Everyone had their saints in heaven, but pay attention to the fundamental concept. Therefore, they found ex-votos dedicated to various gods. However, there is not even a single ex-voto dedicated to an emperor god. When the faithful needed a true god, they did not turn to the emperor. This is a fundamental concept. It makes us understand that we are equal. There are no intelligent monotheists and the stupid pagans. When everyone is born, he hears, "You are lucky to have been born in the place where there is the right religion." This alone already explains everything, but beware. Those differences that have always been presented to us do not actually exist. They weren't that stupid. They had their ex-votos to their gods, which they believed to be true, just as Christians have ex-votos to their divinities or madonnas, etc., that they consider true. Therefore, absolutely nothing changes. But now we come to these concepts of enkithioi and zelem. Why? Because they are the initial concepts. Enkithioi is a term that is used in the Odyssey. And now let's go see it. This is the prefix that means close, but close in terms of intimacy. And here is theoi. We already saw theoi last time, but let's take up a concept by expanding it. It's a term that wasn't originally a noun, but was an adjective that indicated someone's function. And Plato reminds us that theoi comes from thein, which means throwing oneself upwards, therefore running quickly towards the heavens, and was referring to stars, but it also referred to the theoi. That is, to individuals who had this characteristic of running, of throwing themselves towards the sky, which united them to the stars. But here in the notes, there is an important affirmation because it is normally said, once again, that the poor pagans, not knowing the truth of monotheism, deified the stars. Listen to the observation. From the testimonies of Diodorus, Porphyry, Theophrastus, and Plato, it is not possible to believe that astral religion coexisted or could be confused with anthropomorphic polytheism. That is, they were two different things, and felt what astral religion consisted of. To avoid any possible ambiguity, and to ensure that it can be argued that paganism has known different stages and levels, Eusebius intends to show how the primitive astral cult consisted exclusively in the adoration of the stars, considered as pure material elements. He finds a confirmation of this in the fact that it, that is that cult, knew neither temples nor statues nor myths concerning personified divinities. That is, they did not personify the stars. The distinction between the two cults was clear. Then this term, which indicated the running of the stars, passed to indicate the running of those individuals, but they did not personify the stars. Here it is described very clearly. Think, for example, that the Babylonians used trapezoidal geometry to calculate the orbits of Jupiter. So they were able to establish in advance in which area of the sky Jupiter would be found at certain times. You can't calculate the orbit of a god. They weren't that stupid, and they knew it very well. And fortunately, it is highlighted here. But there is another aspect that is interesting. Eusebius is truly a mine, he tells us, as regards the Jews, the most reliable news, since both the names of the places and those of the person are in conformity, are narrated by Sanchuniathan of Berito. Do you remember the one who discovered the deceptions of the priests Egyptians, who had in his hands the memoirs written by Jerombolo, priest of the god Yewo, that is Yahweh? He had dedicated his story to Abibalo, king of Berito, and it had been appreciated by him, that is by the king of Berito, and by those whom he had commissioned to ascertain the accuracy of the facts narrated. Then Sanchuniathan exposed the deception of the Egyptian priests. Things were verified and were considered correct. Look how great it is. They all lived before the Trojan War. So Eusebius mentions the Trojan War as a historical fact, so much so that it becomes a chronological point of reference. They lived before. It's not a story. It's not a fable. It's not an invention. It's not a myth. It's a historical fact, and therefore says, take it as a point of reference because others lived before. It is very concrete, very concrete. All of these lived in an era before the Trojan War and close to the time of Moses, as shown by the succession lists of the Phoenician kings. This is great because it shows us how all these stories intersect. So we have to start thinking about this one history, let's say, of the Mediterranean, of the Middle East, as a story that is interconnected. It is not that the Jewish people exist who live as if in a sort of limbo, in a sort of cloud with their God. The only ones who have discovered the God of monotheism? No, 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 absolutely no. It's perfectly integrated into the others. Look, there is a curiosity that I want to read to you. They are so inserted that in the Book of Maccabees, there is even talk of kinship between the Jews and the Spartans. I read a very short passage of it, let's say in the first Book of Maccabees, chapter 12. In this exchange of letters, it says, Areo, king of the Spartans, and Onia, great priest, salute. Great Jewish priest, of course, salute. It was found in a scripture concerning the Spartans and the Jews, that they are brothers and that they descend from the lineage of Abraham. And then this thing is repeated again later, when, recounting the events of Jason, it is said that this Jason, after having combined a series of things, to escape punishment, died among the Spartans among whom he was almost reduced to seeking refuge in the name of common stock. Now this speech, I must tell you, has been questioned several times and reconfirmed. by at least a couple of ancient writers, it is obviously not very certain, so I have to give you an account of this doubt that exists. However, it is interesting to note that in the Bible itself, we speak of brotherhood, just of kinship, actual relationship, actual parentage, ankythioi. Who does this term refer to in the Odyssey? Ankythioi refers to the Phoenicians, i.e. to that people among whom Ulysses is shipwrecked, is picked up by Nausicaa, who takes him to her father. And in the fifth book of the Odyssey, we speak precisely of these here, ankythioi, of which, thus taken, it is could simply say, it is a matter of interpretation because close to the gods can mean a lot of things. Meanwhile, I said that Anki really indicates a sense of intimacy, but there is an explanation that is very clear, because the king of the Phoenicians, who is the one who receives, hosts Ulysses, and gets the story of his stories told, was the son of Nausitu, who was the son of Poseidon. And you remember those times when I spoke to you about the crossings between the Elohim and the daughters of the Adamites, therefore, both as regards the Bible and as regards the stories of the Greeks. These minglings continuously between one of them and a human, or vice versa, but between a goddess and a human. Poseidon had married Periboea, who was the daughter of Eurymedon. Eurymedon was a giant. So, the consanguinity was clear. The king of the Phaeacians was Poseidon's direct nephew. Do you remember that in the Bible, when it speaks in chapter 6 of Genesis, of the unions between the gods and the Adamites, it says, there were giants on the earth in those times, and even later, when the children of the Elohim came to the daughters of men, and they bore them children. These are the famous heroes of antiquity. Now, if we take this sentence and insert it in this context, we don't have to change anything at all. The consanguinity here declared with this term in the Bible appears and becomes evident when the Adamites are said to have been made with the Tselem of the Elohim. Now, the Tselem of the Elohim is a term which, as the dictionaries say, means something cut out, and derives from the verbal root tezalam, which means cut off. And also in dictionaries, such as Klein of Hebrew Etymology, says that as original meaning, it had something cut off. That is something cut off. And therefore, when the Bible tells us that the Adamites were made with the tzelem of the Elohim, it tells us that they were made with something that was cut off. Just as Eve was then made from Adam with something that was cut out of him. Well, but what is this something that has been cut out? This something is found in the book here that I am reading, Sumerian Mythology, published by UTET, in which exactly this is written. In this passage, in this text that was elaborated by Pettinato, then translated by Heidel, Botero, Kramer, etc. Therefore, we are in the field of academic translations. It speaks of when the Anunna or Anunnaki worked the earth, and says, after the gods had established the rules of heaven and earth, after they had laid the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates to dams and canals, then Enlil, one of the two sons of the ruler of the empire, spoke to them. What do you want to do now? What do you want to create now? O Anunna, great gods, what do you want to do now? The great gods who were seated and the Anuna who decide the fates all together answered Enlil, "In Uzumua of Duranki we will kill the Allah gods so that their blood may sprout mankind." The corvée of the gods is their task. That is, the blood of the Allah is taken, the blood is pulled out, which then in the story of the formation of the Adamu is purified. And purified, obviously, to obtain this. That is to obtain the Tzilem, that something cut off, that material, something that contains the image that is transferred. And we know that this material, something that is cut out and contains the image, is the DNA. And then he says that men forever tend the border ditches. Let them take up the hoe and the working basket for the temple of the great gods, which is suitable for the lofty throne. Let them add field to field. Forever the ditches of cured border. That is, basically, you have a whole list of jobs, and they say, let's do these here and transfer all these hard jobs to them. We sit quietly in our palaces to govern, which is exactly what the Elohim do. They make someone work their Gan Eden, and we actually come to Gan Eden. We know that in the Bible it is written that God placed a Gan in Eden, Mikadem. Mikadem is a term that is translated as to the east. In reality, Mikadem does not mean to the east, because the particle, the prefix mi, indicates from, i.e., therefore indicates origin and kedem, has its original meaning in what comes first, so as to say the Elohim have manufactured that Gan Eden starting as if from a sort of matrix, from a sort of shape that comes first. Therefore not in the east, but from what comes first. And it is a Gan Eden in which the Elohim, we know, have planted every tree that produces good fruit to eat. And this is written in the apocryphal texts, that this statement is true for Gan, and Gan means enclosed and protected garden. So, in reality, they put trees that were good to eat. It was a special place. It was a laboratory where they produced food, and they put their own trees inside. So, in the fifth book of the Odyssey, it is said that the Phaeacians are relatives of the gods, and we have seen that this is not a generic affirmation, but it is a kinship which truly indicates consanguinity. Then we go on to describe the home of the king of the Phoenicians, then the house, the guardians of the house, and we see it. But above all, what interests me here is this. Then outside the courtyard, there was a large vegetable garden near the gates of four jujuri, that is about 10,000 square meters. A hedge runs all around. That is, it is fenced off exactly like the biblical Gan, tall trees in there, in full bloom, pears and garnets and apple trees with shiny fruits and sweet figs and flourishing olive trees. Never their fruit ceases or ends, i.e., continuous production, winter or summer, for the whole year. I.e., the Homeric author himself says it very clearly. But always the breath of Zephyr gives birth to others. Others ripen. Pear on pear withers, apple on apple. And near the bunch, and the fig on the fig. There also a fruitful vineyard was planted, and a part of this in the open ground ripens in the sun. From another, they harvest the bunches, and others they press down. But next to them, there are green bunches that they throw the flower, others as soon as they ripen. Further along the extreme row, neat flower beds and every vegetable turn green all year round. And there are two springs, one for the whole garden spreads out. Even in the Gan, there is a source that is used to water the garden, and then the other goes here in this case to bring water to where the men live. These wondrous gifts of the gods were in the house of Alcino. These wonderful gifts of the gods. Now, in reality, therefore, we are facing a very special garden, a garden in which production is driven. Production is continuous. There is never any interruption. He clearly says it. Summer and winter. It is a special laboratory. He is one of the Gan, in this case, not of the Elohim, but of the Theoi. One of those gardens that they planted Michedem, starting from an original form and therefore starting from a system they had somewhere. Unfortunately, I can't tell you where, but which they then replicated to have this type of production. We always pretend, but pretending lets us enter a fascinating world that connects things. But the gifts that the Phoenicians received in this case from Poseidon do not end with this garden. The king of the Phoenicians asks Ulysses to tell his stories. Then he also asks him where his land is, because then he will have it brought with one of his ships. Here we are in the eighth book, and tell me the land, your people, the city, so that the ships may take you there guided by thought, so that the ships may take you there guided by thought. And one can say, this is a statement thrown out there. It's a fantasy. No. Immediately after, there is the explanation, because the Phoenicians have no helmsmen. There are no rudders like other ships, but they know by themselves the thought and understanding of men. That is, how are these ships commanded? Among other things, they have no nocieri. Nocieri is Kubernetes. It is no coincidence that our cybernetics derives from Kubernetes. That is, the relationship that can be had with mechanisms through, let's say, non-traditional methods. They know by themselves the thought and understanding of men. And they know the cities and the fat fields of all. That is, they had inside the maps of the whole territory, of the seas and of the coasts. And the abyss of the sea passes very fast, a fog and cloud wrapped up. They are never afraid of being harmed or of being lost. They are truly strange ships. We read earlier in one of these authors who deals with Greek myths, and it was written, you can't invent these things that don't exist. They couldn't invent things that don't exist, especially of this type. Ships guided by thought. Ships that don't need a helmsman. Ships that know the route. Ships that know the coasts and territories. Ships that aren't afraid of getting lost in the fog. They travel surrounded by one of their fogs. And then we go back to making a biblical parallelism and go to Exodus 16, ships traveling surrounded by fog, by one of their fogs. In chapter 16 of Exodus, it is written that, while Aaron was speaking, the whole community of children of Israel turned towards the desert. Then they looked at Aaron, and we see the scene well. They turned towards the desert, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. In Hebrew it says, and behold, the kavod of Yahweh showed himself in the cloud. So to see the glory of Yahweh, if it were spiritual glory, we must know that we have to turn around, because it comes in a certain direction. It is not all-encompassing. But here he tells us that they turned around and Yahweh's kavod showed up in the cloud. And the cloud is a concept that often comes up with these appearances of Yahweh, with his kavod, because cloud has a particular meaning. But we will talk about the technology and means with which both the Elohim and the Homeric Theoi traveled, because it seems to me that time has passed abundantly here. Thank you. Bye, and see you next time.